Good morning, Los Angeles, and welcome to another edition of the Weekend Warrior Show. I am so excited. I'm your host, Dr. Robert Clapper. I'm an orthopedic surgeon at Cedars-Sinai, 30 years in studio. One of my favorite guests, the great L.A. Ram icon, the only man to still hold the record in the NFL all these years later of scoring two safeties in a single game. And then he goes and conquers the entire television world with the TV show Hunter. That's right. Fred Dreyer is my guest today. And thanks to the great Mike Horn, better known as Roth, who put us together. But really, the guy who put us together was the great William Shatner, Captain Kirk, because it's become a tradition during the football season to go to William Shatner's house and watch football games with Fred Dreyer, William Shatner. Oh, my God. It's just, I look forward to it. And it really has inspired me to look at the game differently, thanks to Fred Dreyer. Dr. Ranawat, who invented the knee replacement, one of my teachers, used to say, the eyes don't see what the mind doesn't know. I think I'm watching football games. I have no idea what I'm looking at until you listen to what Fred Dreyer tells you you should be looking at. Everybody's excited this season because Tony Romo goes, oh my God, he's lining up in the slot. This is going to be a running play. And then they snap the ball. And sure enough, Tony Romo has now told you ahead of time what's going to happen. Well, Fred Dreyer has that gift as well. And it's really something that I just love being around. So he's my guest today. And one of the things that really piqued my interest was talking to him about the fact that, yes, he's 6 foot six, long arms, long, thin body, but he only weighed 215 pounds when he played, and the offensive lineman weighed 300 pounds. How did you succeed in this collision sport with people who outweighed you by 80 or 85 pounds? And Fred Dreyer said, I used to watch the linemen before the ball was snapped. They couldn't help themselves. They would lift their head up to look at where they were supposed to go. Look at me, so I knew they were going to come at me. And then quickly they'd put their head down. So I knew I'd have to slap him on the side of the helmet to get around him because he was coming at me. This whole idea of nonverbal communication, reading body language, becoming so in tune, living in the moment, the ability to focus allows the good to become great. So where in the world of art, where in the world of sports, where in the world of surgery, because those are my passions. I did 10 hip knee replacements this week, 6 of them yesterday. You do thousands of them, you get a sixth sense, no matter what it is that you do. So where in the world of art, sports, and surgery do you see the idea of nonverbal communication? Well, in art, in 1965, the Beatles played Shea Stadium. 50,000 screaming women. You couldn't hear a thing. And in 1965, musicians didn't have earbuds in their ear. Ringo Starr is in the back of the stage with the three guitar players in front of him. The speakers on top of his head. No earbud. Screaming fans, how is he keeping time to the music? Wait till you hear him tell you the trick that he did. It'll remind you of Fred Dreyer. And what about also in sports? We were blessed to watch Magic Johnson in Showtime with the no-look pass. If you need a recollection, here's Magic Johnson talking about a no-look pass to James Worthy.
Rebounded by Jaminski once, twice, and then Worthy taps the ball to Magic. Magic in the middle, Worthy to the right, Scott to the left. Magic no look pass to Worthy! Scores! Magic Johnson passing the ball in such a deliberate and beautiful way tonight.
No look pass, which he fully admits he saw and was inspired by the great Pete Maravich. And in surgery, those cases this week, one of them on Wednesday, this woman was heavy. She weighed almost 300 pounds, and I'm trying to do her hip replacement through a 3.5-4-inch incision without cutting the muscle, minimally invasive. I'm in a rabbit hole. That's how deep I am from the skin to her hip joint. And across the table for 30 years was Gene Crawford. Now I have the great Carlos Cabrera. You got to realize, in the operating room, I have a hat on. I have a mask on. You can't see my lips. You can't see my nose flaring. You can't see anything except my eyes and my eyebrows. And yet, when I'm deep and I need to move a millimeter to get away from the sciatic nerve and get closer to what I need to do, deep in this hole across the table, Carlos or Gene Crawford, they could not see inside the wound that I'm working on. And yet, ever so slightly, I feel the leg moved, adjusted, because they're holding the leg ever so slightly. And now I can see everything again. They're looking at my forehead. They're looking at my eyebrows. They're looking at my eyes and can sense they need to move towards 3 o'clock versus 9 o'clock of the clock of your acetabulum, your socket. Yes, I use nonverbal communication in my world as a surgeon. So we'll get into that as well. Clapper Vision has got to be about Boogie Cousins. Boogie Cousins, I was on with Steve Mason this week talking about as soon as it went down, boom, it's like Batman, right? They want to get a hold of Batman. They put a giant bat in the sky. Quick, you have to come to God and save Gotham City. Whenever there's an injury, it's fantastic. Steve Mason goes, put a giant bone in the sky. Get Dr. Clapper. We need to talk to him right away. So I did. And it's just tragic that he's torn his ACL. On the same side his quadriceps was sprained, which he was coming back from. But it just teaches you, again, all about the relationship between the muscles, the joint, the ligaments. On Wednesday morning before I started surgery, I went to one of the best lectures I've ever been to by the Mount Rushmore man in this country for the ACL. His name is Dr. Freddie Fu. He's from the University of Pittsburgh. He taught me something this week about the ACL that I never knew before. And in his mind, the ligament behaves a lot like your heart. Talk about a Clapper Vision. This is a Freddie Fu Vision. He said, because what we're realizing now is the ligament stretches and contracts and stretches again, like the heart squeezes the blood out, and then it relaxes to fill with blood again, and then it contracts again. What he's now realizing is there is that same heart-like contraction relaxation in the ACL. So complicated a structure, more than we ever imagined. He also said something that was fascinating to me. When I asked him, how do you explain all these non-contact ACLs, in your opinion, Dr. Fu? And he said, well, you have to always, there's many things, but one of the things you have to think about are the sneakers. I said, the sneakers? He goes, Zion Williamson was so lucky his shoe exploded. I said, why? Because if it didn't, that force would have gone right through and he would have torn his ACL. He sprained his medial collateral ligament, but thank God the shoe gave out. Because if the shoe didn't give out, all that force would have gone into his knee. And remember, in the old days, skiers wore boots that just went above the ankle. So we as orthopedic surgeons, you know what we did for people who were in ski accidents? We had to fix their fractured tibias. We had to put rods and plates because they broke their tibia, their shin bone. Then later came these newer ski boots. Companies like Rossignol and all the, what did they do with the boots? They weren't just above your ankle. They went higher up your tibia, right? The modern day ski boot goes higher up. Guess what? We don't have any more boot top fractures in the tibia to treat anymore. You know what we treat? Torn ACLs. Because the force has to go someplace when the bindings don't give way. Instead of snapping your tibia, you tear your ACL. Fascinating. It's like a warm, fuzzy feeling when you learn something. And I learned something this week. All right, let's get into today's show. Can you imagine trying to play the drums in tune with your bandmates when this is going on?
Well, she loves you.
Ringo Starr cannot hear the music. But listen to him doing his drumming in the back. 50,000 screaming women. How does he keep time? Here's the answer. This is Paul McCartney and Ringo Starr being interviewed about how they communicate nonverbal. How Fred Dreyer can figure out what that 300-pound lineman is going to do before the lineman even knows what he's going to do.
We'd come in here, and it was only me and John knew what we were going to do that day, because we'd just written it. George Martin had come down from the sort of grown-ups box, and he'd come down and he'd sort of say, what are we going to do, chaps? So we go, okay, if there's anything that you want, or whatever it was, you know. And in that next 1.5 hours, we'd make that song.
Baby's good to me, you know she's happy as can be, you know she said so. I'm in love with her and I feel fine.
The hours that the four spent in a studio with the door locked, seeing each other, the time they put in, this is information that goes into Ringo Starr's brain about how John moves his elbow, how Paul moves his foot. This is all imprinted in Ringo Starr's brain from thousands of hours together as kids.
And then when we end up at Shea, because that is the biggest thing we'd ever done, it was like far out. It was like, what?
Same old thing happened every day.
Shea Stadium.
At New York's Shea Stadium, in August of 1965, they played before 56,000 fans.
Screaming fans. They're not in the studio anymore.
I mean, at first, that screaming was great, because it meant we were a success. It was just like, she loved... And it was like, hey, whoa! And after a while, it was like, I can't hear you. Wait a minute, you know.
But it had become part of it.
Yeah.
It was like, that's what happens when we go on stage. This is what happens.
Yeah.
And we did diminish a little as musicians. Though it sounds good.
Listen to Ringo say, I couldn't even hear them. This is where he gives you the trick, the explanation of how he did it.
We played our best no matter what. Mm-hmm. And I couldn't hear them.
I couldn't hear them.
I was playing, you know, to his foot tapping, to John's bouncing, you know, and when they went, I couldn't hear that. I just saw the head. Oh, it's the woo!
You knew it was time for
the bill. I knew. Yeah, I'm going to do the bill.
Singing a song called Boys Ring Now!
And the thing is, though, because we put in so many hours as kids, we instinctively knew what to do as a band. We were making a pretty good noise most of the time, not always.
It's more than just seeing. Magic Johnson with his no-look pass. He's not even looking down. He's learning how to use sonar in his head to know where his teammates are to make a no-look pass. Let me remind you of what it sounded like with Chick Hearn and Keith Erickson describing Magic Johnson playing and never looking down.
Both clubs are out of fouls. Magic holds it up underneath. He gets to Nixon. Nixon scores. Magic Johnson's bullet pass. We're tied at 110 from behind. Long lead pass to Worthy underneath the score from Magic. How can Magic read that floor that well?
Dribbling the basketball. He never looks down.
And so here's Magic Johnson telling you, here, you got more than two eyes that God gave you. You got 100 eyes.
You know, when you're born, they tell us we only have two eyes. But that's not true. Actually, we have about 100 eyes. We just got to train ourselves to use all those eyes. For instance, say we're coming down the court on a fast break. Now you're looking to see who's behind you, who's in front of you, who's running fast, who's running slow, where's the defense, who's free, who's got a shot, who can block that shot, who's open, the passing lanes, the cracks, the seams, you're just moving fast. Now, who's going to see all of that with just two eyes? You got to train yourself. I say it again, you got to train yourself to use everything, to see the whole floor, to use all those eyes. Now, when I look side to side, I see a fan, I see two ladies, I see five men, I see a chair, I see a ladder, I see a basket, I see some bleachers, I see all of those things. Now, that's an exercise you can use for your eyes, because passing is with your hands and your eyes.
And finally, from Magic.
We're about to go into passing, and I really love this part of the game, because passing, you make somebody else score 2 points. You set the offense up for another guy. And that's mental part of the game. because you have to understand what type of pass you're going to make, whether it's a bounce pass, a chest pass, an overhead pass, or a baseball pass.
How to work with your teammates, how to make yourself better. It's the whole idea of nonverbal communication, and nobody was better at it than the great Fred Dreyer. Coming up next, we'll get into it. The number is 877-710-ESPN. I'll take your calls later. The clinic will be open. Right now, we got to talk to my favorite L.A. Ram, Fred Dreyer, in studio. You're listening to the one and only Weekend Warriors Show here on ESPN L.A. 710. Wow. This is the Beatles. This is a live show. Curtis, Steve Paletta has some big shoes to fill, but man, you're filling them today. Thank you. Because to hear them in a live performance is what I'm talking about. Not in studio, where it's easier, but keeping time and making their music come to life with 50,000 screaming women and men. That's the challenge. I'm joined now by the great Fred Dreyer. And Fred, I had a professor who invented the knee replacement, Dr. Ranawat. He's still alive. He's in his late 80s. And he used to say, the eyes don't see what the mind doesn't know. The ears don't hear what the mind doesn't know. You conquered the world of sports like none other. You conquered the world of media and television. What a beautiful Renaissance idea of combining those two worlds. When you hear Ringo Starr and Paul McCartney talk about how they were able to communicate in a nonverbal way, what is it that you hear?
You know, it's interesting. There's so many things that you, as you get older, that come to you, that unfold to you, that are very close to you, that you've never really kind of looked at before until you get a perspective of age on it. Mm. And I listen to what the Beatles are talking about there. And you know that all of that what they're giving us now is a remembrance of how it unfolded to them then. Hmm. And what I pull out of all of this is, I just wrote something down here. In September of 63, my father died. Mm-hmm. I was 17 years old.
Wow.
And in November of 63,
Kennedy
was mm-hmm. murdered. And then the Beatles, we started listening to the Beatles. And then in 64, they showed up in America. But that period of time with those three elements changed my life. And at that point in time, I was beginning to flower out my own fantasies about what my direction was. My dad's dead. I kept thinking, my dad's dead. What am I going to do? Hmm. Who do I talk to? What are my actions? Hmm. Can I go in that direction? Will that be okay to go that way? Or should I go that way? Or so I sat around and I did nothing for a couple of years. Hmm. Until one day I stumbled on my friends at the beach, and all my pals were over at El Camino College playing football. Hmm. So I got in my car because I was lonely, hmm. because I had no kind of specific direction. I said, I'll just go over there to see my friends, to be comforted by my friends.
What were their names?
Oh, Luigi De Felice.
Really?
Yeah. Luigi was a guard. He was from Italy.
Did you meet his mother?
Oh, yeah.
Did she cook for you?
We had wine. They had homemade wine. It was like lighter fluid. It was great, and they never spoke English hardly. The parents,
oh my God.
And Luigi was so great, and God bless him. But I went over to see Luigi, and I went over to see a couple other people. Of course, you know, community college was a compilation of a lot of kids from a lot of high schools mm-hmm. around the area. You know, it was a 2-year school. You went there, and sports wise, and mm-hmm. then you moved on, or you didn't. But when I went over there, I went over to see my friends, but I was pulled in that direction because subconsciously I wanted to take a look at what was going on in football. Hmm. You know, and so I got over there, and I saw my friends, and a coach came up to me, and he knew who I was. And
really?
I don't know how and why he did. I played 1 year at Lawndale High School, 1 year of college football, 1 year of high school football. I was a baseball player, actually. 4 years of baseball. But until I hurt my elbow, I could have used you then.
What was his name, the coach?
Bill Vincent.
So he comes up to you. Hi, Fred Dreyer.
He says to me, he says, "Hey, where have you been?"
Oh, wow.
And I said, "Well, you know, I've been here and there and everybody." And he says, "Listen." I said, "I'm here to see Luigi." He says, "Come here." So we walk off the field and go into his office. While he's telling me, you know, Luigi's he's playing guard for us and he's doing a hell of a job. He's rummaging through his desk and he's getting all these papers out. And he gets a pen. And while he's talking to me about Luigi, he spins the papers around, slides them over and says, "Here, just sign right there and right there." So I sign. I'm enrolling in school. He enrolls me in school while I'm asking about Luigi. And so after it's all over, he goes, "Yeah, Luigi's he's doing really well here, and he's really great, and he's a terrific kid, and let's go out to the practice field." So I say, "Well, I got to get going and stuff," and so I'll walk you out. So he walks me out back across the field, and he says, "Now listen, Monday, you got to show up for class." I said, "What do you mean?" He says, "You're in school now." And after you enroll on Monday, wow, come over to the coach's office and we'll get you a uniform. That's how I kind of slid.
How did you feel?
Football.
I mean, I love it. I can't. If I asked you what you ate for breakfast yesterday, you would have trouble telling me. But look at the detail. Every single second of that moment, your heart must have fluttered. That number one, he knew your name. He knew who you were,
yeah,
and he gave you a direction.
I'd never met him before,
and he gave you a direction.
Yeah, he was
in
a
life,
guy who walked
an
across.
Angel
he walked across his practice field, and said, "Hey," like he had known me for 10 years. Wow. Hey, he said, "What are you doing right now?" I said, "Oh, I'm just stubbornly and stammering around." He says, "Come here." And he puts me in school. He doesn't even ask me. He just says, "Here, look, this is where you should be."
He gave you direction.
This is where he did it. And that guy,
Could, on some level, could you imagine that your father in heaven came through that guy to tell you that?
I think back on all of that period of time when I was 17, without a father and not much direction.
Wow.
I was too busy and emotionally mm-hmm. torn to sit in class and study botany. You know, I wasn't a student then.
Right.
But I was a student of life in a different way.
Right. Yes.
And so by going in an athletic direction, you know, I also should put down here in 64, I hurt my elbow and my baseball days were done. I was a pitcher. And wow. I had a moment there for a while until my arm took off. And so there I am, a bad arm, driving from Manhattan Beach, not too far from your house, driving from Manhattan Beach over on Crenshaw and Redondo Beach Boulevard, over into, I guess it's Lawndale. I don't know if it's Lawndale or not, but I drove over there, and then that day, that period of time, my whole entire life changed, and I found a direction, and everything that happened to me felt correct.
The first play, you're in uniform. Do you remember the moment when you said to yourself, "It just feels right"? Did he high-five you, the coach? What was it that even lit more of a fire? Do you remember the first play or the first game when you were in that high in El Camino?
I remember standing in line getting my uniform.
You do?
Yeah. And Pops, you know, with a bulbous nose and a cigar in his mouth. Literally, it was a cliche. He gives me my uniform and stuff.
And says
to me, he says, "Good luck. Good luck." That's what he'd say. "Here's your uniform. Good luck. Good luck."
Wow.
He understood. He'd seen this a million times, young kids coming in, going out for football. And
wow.
Good luck means don't get hurt.
The nonverbal communication, Fred Dreyer. Did someone coach you to look for it? Was it for survival that you realized this guy's going to kill me unless I figure this out? How did it come about for you?
Well, it's like anything else. You know, if you hang around long enough, you're going to get knocked out, you know, as they say. You know, a fighter is a loser. And you might win, but your head and your face doesn't know you lost or you won. And so you're going to take it. Something's going to happen to you if you don't arm yourself with an understanding of what the hell I'm doing here. And that's one of the interesting things. I look at young kids today. They're not talked to by people who know to give kids an understanding and a perspective on the ladder of progression in their life. This is just a step in young kids' lives, and that's what it was. And I wanted to understand, where the hell am I? What am I doing here with this uniform on? It doesn't kind of quite fit, but it's all right. I'll make do. And here I am trying to figure out, am I supposed to be out here? I guess so. I guess I am. I'll just go with the flow because I'm comfortable with my friends. And that's all I've ever really cared about, it seems, in life. You know, you look back on things and I just wanted to be with my friends.
Wow. So interesting. All right, the number's 877-710-ESPN. Nonverbal communication. That's the topic today. I want to talk about surgery that I did this week. I certainly want to talk about Boogie Cousins. Klay Thompson, no one touched him, tore his ACL. Boogie Cousins, he bumped knees, but to tear his ACL, what is going on in the knee? And I did surgery on an ACL this week. You need to understand how your body works. If you've hurt yourself, let me know. The number is 877-710-ESPN, and there's a donut. I'm a donutologist, right? A cardiologist, an expert in hearts. I'm a donutologist. I'm an expert in donuts. And my favorite donut has cinnamon and sugar. And I'm going to tell you where you can get it. Coming up next on the Weekend Warriors Show here on ESPN LA 710. Welcome back, Weekend Warriors. The Beach Boys singing about California girls. Well, Fred Dreyer, you get signed by the Giants. You play 3 years in New York. Oh, my God, I can't wait. You're a football player while Woodstock is going on. Do you realize that?
Yes.
Did you tell me your relationship with Woodstock as a New York Giant in 1969?
I remember being August, I believe.
Mm-hmm.
Just got out of the college All-Star game in Chicago playing against the Jets. They were just world champions after 68.
Joe Namath.
The whole thing. The whole kit and caboodle. He was the biggest star in America at that point in time.
With his raccoon coat.
And I'm drafted by the Giants, so I show up, and I'm on the other side of town. So I was the number one draft choice.
Wow.
Joe's the number one guy in town. And so as I come into town, my experience coming out of playing against Joe Namath and the Jets in 68 in Chicago, and now having to play opposite that entity in New York as a rookie, I came in right when there was a front page on the New York Times of the aerial view of Woodstock.
Oh, my God.
And inside the fold was a picture of Max Yasgur.
The farmer.
His farm. And the thought was, what the hell did he let all those people in his... What did he let those people on his property for? So,
fantastic.
You know, it was a great time. It was a great time. I mean, it was such a wonderful experience. And I remember walking down 64th Street, and I was going to cross. I walked across the park over to the west side, mm-hmm. and then I walked down 5th and Broadway to the
split
to the
59th Street.
What's the Flatiron?
Columbus Circle.
Flatiron building.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
I said, I got to see this building. I remember it from a newspaper photograph. There I am standing there looking at this wedge building. I said, this is great. There must be a bunch of other stuff like this around here.
Wow.
So that's all I did on my off days and stuff was walk around New York City.
We played California Girls, Curtis did, because after you're in New York, you get traded to the Patriots in New England in Boston, and you said, I ain't going there. I'm going to get my way to see the California Girls. And you made it happen.
Yeah. It was interesting. In those days, players just didn't dictate to ownership. You know, today everybody's saying, I'm a free agent. I'm going to play out my option. And he goes, yeah, I understand that. But try and do it in 1971.
You did it.
I did it. Yeah.
Wow.
I when I was drafted in 69, I went back there, and there was something. I didn't know anything. Mm. So my attorney and I says, he says, well, they probably want to put you into a 3-4 year deal. And I said, I don't want to be in a 3 or 4 year deal. I said, can I just do it 1 year at a time? And he says, okay, let's go back and ask. I said, no, just tell them. Look, if this all thing falls apart, I just go back down to San Diego State. I'll just go back to school. I don't have any problem doing that, you know.
Wow.
So I negotiated a 1-year contract, certainly with an option. So I was there for 3 years, and I played with the Giants on 1-year contracts for 3 years. And at the end of the second year, I said, okay, this is my third year. And they said, well, can't we sign you to a long-term deal now, 4 or 5 years? I said, no, because that's going to eat up my entire experience in pro football. And I'm not going to be stuck anywhere under a contract that I don't eventually want to get out of.
Oh, my God. You were ahead of your time.
Oh, well, I was way ahead of my time.
On so many levels.
And so I set myself up to where I just said, I'm not signing any contracts. Don't talk to me about any contracts. So the season went on, and so the beginning of the third season was actually my option year from my second year, right?
Oh my God.
So I didn't sign a contract. So now I'm playing for 10% less on my contract, and I'm playing on my option. And I'm probably one of the only people in the league at that time was playing on my option. So at the end of the year, I realized if I wait, this was in December of 72, January of 72, January, February, March, April. If I wait 4 more months, I'm a free agent. So I waited till May 1st. And of course, on draft day, they traded me to the Patriots.
And you said, I ain't going there.
And listen to this. This is one of the highlights of my career. I'm home on draft day, January of 1972, and the phone rings. My mom says to me, there's a guy.
By the way, this Mad magazine I brought is from January of 1972.
See? This is exactly the time. This is exactly when this happened. There's a man from New England. He says he's from the New England Patriots. I'm thinking, they traded me there? I said, what? I said, let me take the phone call. So I said, hello. Now, I answer the phone, and the dopes had me on speakerphone in the press room. What a mistake. So I said, yeah. And he said, Fred Dreyer, this is John Mazur, head coach of the New England Patriots. And we're here with Upton Bell, the general manager, and we're here just to congratulate you. We've traded for you, and you and Julius Adams are now the two defensive ends. He went on and on and on. I couldn't get a word in edgewise. I said, hey, wait a minute. Now I'm on speakerphone. Hey, wait a minute. What the hell's going on? And he says, we've just traded for you. You're now a New England Patriot. And I said, wait a minute. You know what you should have done? You should have called my attorney before you traded for me. Now, when I said that,
you could feel a pin drop.
The press. You couldn't hear anything. It was like you were on a resuscitator. All you could hear was a. Now the guy said, oh, "Just a second. Upton Bell wants to talk to you. Hey, Fred, this is Upton Bell, general manager. Hey, look, we're just so happy to have you. I said, Upton, can I call you Upton? Yes, please. Look, you made a mistake. I'm not going to New England. Just a second. So there's a moment, and he says, we're going to get back to you, Fred. We're going to call you. I said, call John Thomas. He's in Westwood. That's my attorney. Call John Thomas, and let's work this thing out, because I'm not going. I'm not doing in New England what I was trying to get out of with the Giants. You guys are in the same boat. You guys don't know what the hell you're doing, and I'm not going to be a part of that. Wow. So get me the hell out of there. Now, I didn't know where I wanted to go anyway. So
not the West Coast? You didn't think you
wanted
to come home?
I figured I'd go back to, if the worst, I'd go back to San Diego. They weren't very good either, the Chargers. And so John Madden was the head coach in Oakland. He was my coach. You know, John recruited me to San Diego State.
Oh my God.
Listen to this. I don't want to bore you with this.
This is the most interesting thing ever.
It's San Diego State. When I was there in 68-69, Don Coryell was the head coach.
Yes. Air Coryell.
Yes. John Madden was the defensive coach.
Wow.
Joe Gibbs was the offensive line coach.
Oh, my God.
Rod Dauhauer, the quarterback coach. And Ernie Zampezi, the great Ernie Zampezi, was the defensive backfield coach. Those guys collectively prepared me for not just pro football, but
life.
The understanding of my relationship to this sport helped me a great deal. It's where I began to pay attention to what they were telling me. They would always just say, look, we're a college. We weren't even a university at the time. We were a college where every year, Don Coryell lost half of his team because he only recruited junior colleges. High school kids didn't go there. They went to universities, four-year schools. He went to SC, UCLA, that type of thing. So all the kids who kind of like washed out or got a sour taste from being in big universities, you know, universities would sign these guys up and they'd have a traveling squad. SC had 127 people get off a bus. You know, they ate up all the talent in Southern California and sat them on the bench, where when they should have said, hey, I should have went to a junior college, or I should have went to San Diego State, you know, someplace where I could play right away. So Coryell loses half of his team every year. And so when I went down there, my junior year, they had 13 people drafted into pro football.
Wow.
Because they knew how to pass, they knew how to pass block, and they knew how to cover. You know, it was a great place to be.
You know, when I think about what you did, we only have like a minute left before we take a break, that your ability to become such a success in the art world of television, and I can't wait to talk to you about Andy Warhol. We're going to do that after 8 o'clock. But John Madden's career is even bigger now with the video game business.
Right.
He had an open, creative enough mind to take sports and go into the art world of video game. You did it in television. No wonder these guys were so inspiring to you. You really did follow in the footsteps of these creative minds. They weren't just athletes. They were artists. That's what came about.
Well, what was really interesting is that's where I became a student. That's where I applied myself, and I really paid attention to detail, as they say.
That's what LeBron James says about Pat Riley.
Yeah.
He didn't go to college for 4 years. He went to Pat Riley University.
That's right.
For 4 years in Miami.
That's right.
People don't recognize, but that's a better education than actually getting the diploma.
Yeah, and look, life is.
But you got to pay attention, Fred Dreyer.
Yeah, well,
LeBron James pays attention. So do you.
Well, you have to pay attention, and you have to have focus, and you have to have discipline to know that even though you work hard, you may not get the answer in a timely fashion that you want. You may have to wait for it.
Right. Wow. Amazing. The great Fred Dreyer. We'll take a break. The number is 877-710-ESPN. You're listening to the one and only Weekend Warriors Show here on ESPN LA 710. Welcome back, Weekend Warriors. Talking to the great Fred Dreyer. From what I understand, Fred Dreyer, the two safeties you scored were both in the fourth quarter. Is that true?
I think they were sooner than that.
That's what I read, that they were both in the fourth quarter, which makes it mean that you did one and boom, you did another one. And nobody's ever done that before.
Yeah.
Did you know you were in the presence of whatever spirit or greatness while that's all going on? Or is it something you just reflect on and go, wow, I can't believe that happened. Like, it's an out-of-body experience.
Well, it's interesting. To me, I mean, I speak just for myself, but I do know it's universally acknowledged that you can't spend much time in that sport without realizing that every moment is beyond your scope. Mm. What you're experiencing is compressed. You're the length of a football, at least I am, a length of a football away from a guy who wants to pound your head in. And then you got a guy to the right of you and a tight end. Then you got running backs. You got all this stuff. So all of this experience, Chuck Knox coming to the Rams in 1973, and this was Chuck's first year that I got the two safeties. But there was such energy and the newness. They had new uniforms. They were now selling out. They had 75,000 people every week against the Saints. No matter who it was, people were just excited. And when people around you are excited, it bleeds off. You know, it affects you. So when you go to work, you're excited because you say, hey, look at all these people care about what we do. You know? And so you show up and you do what you do, and the results are the results. But that day was a day, you know, you look at the films, and you say to yourself, I could have a big day here.
Wow.
And that's what I do. I make a note on my scouting report, you know, big day. Wow. And I circle it. And it comes true.
Wow.
You know, if we have time, I want to tell you the story. There's a story I wanted to tell you that, I just forgot it. I'll remember it by the time.
Tell me about Dr. Curlin. Did you meet Dr. Curlin?
Oh, yeah. I loved Dr. Bob. Yeah, he was great.
Was he using crutches? Was he? Could you tell he had ankylosing spondylitis when you met him?
Yeah, I did.
And what did you love about him? He told you the truth?
He was
my teacher.
Yes. He was great in spite of his handicap.
Right.
You know, he fought through so much to just get out of the car.
You know, we as a fellow of his, this is going back to 1988, you had a choice. Mm-hmm. You had to do a research project. And I figured I'm going to get the most out of working with Dr. Job and Dr. Curlin. So I went and asked Dr. Curlin, actually asked his secretary, of all the teams, the Dodgers, the Rams, the Lakers, the Kings, who is Dr. Curlin's favorite sport? Which is Dr. Curlin's favorite sport? Because I might as well do the research project about that. And God bless his secretary said to me, Dr. Clapper, he could give a rip about all these teams. You know what his favorite sport is? I said, what? She said, horse racing. Yeah. He loves going to Hollywood Park. His favorite athletes are the jockeys. I said, has anyone ever done a research project on the injuries to the jockeys? She said, no. I said, well, that's what I'm doing. And I remember, because he was a gruff guy. He was nice to Fred Dreyer. He was not nice to Robbie Clapper. I banged on his door. He was doing some paperwork. And I said, Dr. Curlin? Yes. He has no idea who anyone is, but Fred Dreyer knows who it is. Hi, I'm one of the fellows, Robert Clapper. Oh, yeah, what do you need? I said, for my research project, I was thinking of doing a paper on the injuries to the jockeys. He's like half listening to me. Now he goes, what did you say? Who are you? What? He got so excited. He reached into his drawer and he gave me a pin. And apparently when you wear this pin, it means you're one of the owners of Hollywood Park. He said, you put this pin on. You get to go any place you want in the park. You get to talk to the jockeys, the trainers, the this, the that. He was like falling over himself that I was going to now do a paper on the, and I did this fascinating paper. We have a minute, I'll tell you. In England, the jockeys ride on, they're called quarter horses, so they ride on tracks that have gopher holes in them, that have, you know, they're not the most kept up, and the jockeys stick their feet deeper into the stirrup, because when the horse gets caught up in the hole or whatever, the non-manicured track, they could get thrown. So they sit, they put their feet deeper in the stirrups so they can stay on top of the horse. In America, the tracks are much more manicured. They're cleaner. So the jockey can ride on the balls of their feet, on the metatarsal heads. Their feet are not as deep in the stirrup. And if you're a jockey, whether you're in England or America, you're going to get thrown. So when you get thrown, if your foot is deeper in the stirrup, you break your tibia and fibula. You fracture your ankle in a certain pattern. In America, you get thrown from the horse. I identified a different type of ankle fracture than the British jockeys. He thought this was like the greatest thing ever. And I used to sit in the ambulance, Hollywood Park, before the gates would open. I'm in the ambulance with a veterinarian, and I'm the doctor for the jockey. He's the doctor for the horse. And it was amazing. The gates would open, and every once in a while, the horse in the number three slot, instead of going straight, would make a right turn. Because he's a horse. It's not like he went to college. He would make a right turn, and they would all tumble. And Chris McCarron and Lafitte Pincay and all these guys, they would go flying in the air with uniforms. All they had was their helmet. Any padding weighed more, so they didn't have them have any more padding. These guys would, you know, have horrific injuries, more so than a hockey player or a football player. But Curlin was so in love with me studying these injuries to the jockeys, I got to be very close with him, which was a real pleasure.
Well, it was interesting you say it, because that's all they would talk about on getaway day, on Fridays, if we're on a road game or something. Curlin would show up, and sometimes he'd show up with Bill Shoemaker.
Right, that was his buddy.
He was a real close pal. And so they would talk horse racing while we were practicing.
Wow.
It was really a lot of fun. And then right toward the end, I would go over to Dr. Curlin's house and sit with him. He had a huge screen put up at the foot of his bed on the wall.
Wow.
And he was bedridden at this time. And I would go over there and I would, you know, sit with him, and we'd watch it live from Hollywood Park. He would just sit there and do nothing but watch horse racing.
You were a different kind of athlete, Fred Dryer. I don't think many of your teammates were trying to make a bonding relationship with the team doctor like you did, because you saw sports through many different lenses.
I was interested in I was interested in all the things that were around me, and yeah. I think it came out of an appetite to speak to my father. I've got to know this experience. You know, I played a lot of sports as a kid, and I remember being 12 years of age, you know, my dad took my brother and I to the Coliseum to see the Bears and the Rams in 1958 when I was 12, and that was the same year the Dodgers came to L.A., and we went to a Dodger game here at the Coliseum,
I want to get into it. The art life of Fred Dryer. We'll do it 8:15. Andy Warhol, Howard Cosell, and Hunter. This is what I want to talk at 8:15, which I'm going to do with the great Fred Dryer. The number is 877-710-ESPN. I'm going to tell some stories about nonverbal communication. Coming up next on the Weekend Warriors Show here on ESPN LA 710.